Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. For today's episode, TW founder and publisher Martha Nichols sits down to talk about AI with Naomi Barron. Barron is a linguist and professor emerita at American University. Her longtime research interests include language and technology, reading, first language acquisition, the relationship between speech and writing, the history and structure of English, and higher education. The author of numerous articles and 10 books, such as 2021's How We Read Now and Words on Screen from 2015, Barron is currently exploring the future of reading in an AI world. Her newest book, Who Wrote This? How AI and the Lure of Efficiency Threaten Human Writing, from Stanford University Press 2023, is the main focus of her conversation with Martha this May. This book was created from two avenues of research. One was the history and current state of AI, as well as the roles of language and creativity in its use and development. And the other was specific to writing. How is AI going to affect us as writers?
Welcome, Naomi. I feel very fortunate to be having this conversation with you about generative AI and writing, especially at this particular cultural moment in the spring of 2024. It's at the end of the semester on many U.S. college campuses, and it's not even 2 years since the public release of ChatGPT by OpenAI, and yet there's a great amount of ferment about it, as I know you are well aware. So, and I'm very, very well aware too, and in my capacity as a writing instructor. So you've been researching the impact of technology on reading and writing for decades, and your latest book, Who Wrote This? How AI and the Lure of Efficiency Threaten Human Writing, speaks to the current dilemma so many of us face as writers and as teachers of writing. So before we get into it, I'd like you to read a brief excerpt from the last chapter of your book, your coda, and that's titled Why Human Authorship Matters. So if you could read just a couple of paragraphs at the beginning there, that would be great.
It's my pleasure. What if the dream came true? Imagine a world where AI's current writing challenges have been solved, where large language models or their successors don't churn out ugliness, where using them is energy efficient, where predictive texting, spell check, and grammar programs are infallible, where AI can produce lengthy texts that are non-repetitive, stylistically interesting, factually accurate, and always on topic. Oh, and can generate text that's indistinguishable from what you might have written. Where would this world leave us as humans? While some of these accomplishments will take longer than others, the future is already knocking.
Thank you for bringing up so many issues, many of which I'm very, very interested in. And I've got many questions. And full disclosure, after coming up with my own interview notes, I asked ChatGPT to generate questions for you. I'll include one of those in our conversation. I'm not going to tell you what it is until the end. You can see if you can tell.
And then I have to guess which it was.
Yes!
Let's see.
Okay. So yes, I very, very much appreciated the way that you laid everything out in the book. But it led me to many questions of my own, including one, what is good writing? How do you define it? A lot of times, I mean, I'm a writing instructor, and sometimes we make these assumptions that students, for example, know what a story is, or know what writing is, or know what good writing is, or why they shouldn't use AI, or whatever we're talking about. And in fact, I'm not sure that it's that obvious.
So I'll begin with a disclosure. I do not have your skills, your background, your flair and finesse as a writing teacher? I write, I teach, but to some extent, when I'm looking at my students' writing, my goal is not what is the finished product, such that it would make it into a literary magazine, because I don't work on fiction. There could be nonfiction literary magazine, but just take fiction as prototypic. My goal is rather to say, are students thinking through what's in their mind? Are they critiquing what they have thought about, what they have written? The biggest challenge I have, and have had for decades, is convincing students their reasons to rewrite, to rethink and to rewrite. And I care much more about the quality of their thinking, the logic of their arguments, their ability to take a risk in proposing a hypothesis. You know, so why do we think that Old English evolved into Middle English the way that it did? Well, there are some hypotheses, and they don't all agree with each other. Was it the invasion of the Vikings? And if so, to what extent did that matter? Well, go out, you know, or what is the, why is the particular phrase grammatical or not grammatical? And why do we change our sociolinguistic habits so that some things that used to not be okay are now okay? Give me a hypothesis and defend it, or critique other people's approaches. That's really what, for many of us, who are not writing teachers par excellence, are most concerned with. And this, I will say, is why I am so concerned about the potentially slippery slope of using generative free trade transformers of whichever ilk, whether you want to call it ChatGPT, or whether now we're on GPT-4, or whether you're on Claude 3, or there's a whole bunch out there, and there will be more. Does the availability of those tools to write your argument for you, and these days incredibly well, what could happen, you know, we can all poke fun and poke holes in what ChatGPT could do in, let's call it December 22 or the first couple of months of 2023, but that program was built with bumper pads around it. It was a stupid program in many, many ways. It was a program that we have to remember was not released so that we could all use it for our own benefits. It was released so that OpenAI could get free data from us. And Sam Altman knew exactly what he was doing. And I'm sure you know, there was no anticipation that there would be an uptake from more than the equivalent of a handful of people. So you get a handful of data, but that's better than nothing. The millions and millions of people who said, wow, this can write my essay for me, this can write my PowerPoint slides, whatever, that was not anticipated. Okay, so don't judge the ability of these tools by what first came out. My concern, and the more I read contemporary research, you know, that's coming out last week or yesterday, on how much logical argumentation can be done and how much sophisticated writing can be done by AI, the more I worry about the temptation to let AI do our thinking for us when we write. But in general in life, because not everything we want to think about do we write down.
Well, I think that's, I mean, that's my fear too, as a writing instructor. And I teach in a journalism program. So much of what you're talking about you know, logic, argument, what are you observing, what's factually accurate, how do you interpret what you see, what you're reporting on, that's all crucial to the project of journalism. But if, of course, as you lay out, at the book, when you're talking about sort of labor issues for the writing professions, including journalism, sure. You know, the argument, including from Sam Altman and everybody else, about what's going to happen there is, oh, this system will free up journalists to do the thinking. And so all this kind of rote stuff that they were doing. Well, yeah, ha. But that is the argument. And meanwhile, journalism as a profession is falling apart. This is not a large stretch for me to say that in this forum. So I think that there are real fears about who is doing the thinking and who's behind the curtain is right. Part of what I, you know, me as a journalist, the way I see it is, wow, there's all this authoritative writing out there. And, you know, if you do any testing with a ChatGPT or Claude or any of these things, they all sound so authoritative. They all slightly different voices, but they all sound so authoritative unless you tell them not to be. I mean, right. But the thing is they do, they're meant to be persuasive. And for me, that's a red flag as a journalist. You know, that kind of persuasive false authority thing.
There are alternative perspectives on many issues, and you'd like to think that a good journalist could represent those. One of the important things to know about journalism, and I write about this in the book, is one has to be fair to ask in asking what are the challenges that journalism as a profession has, because those challenges predate generative, pre-trained transformers. There's no question about it.
Definitely.
Another thing that gives me a little bit of hope in terms of this notion of authoritative and, you know, just the facts and here you have it, done, is the results of a study that I did after the book came out, where it was graduate students in Italy. I happened to be doing some lecturing in a summer school there, and I gave them a questionnaire in advance. And I asked, what kind of writing would you like to have ChatGPT do for you? And what kind of writing would you like to keep for yourself? And, you know, it was across the spectrum that I got answers. But the general response was, things that are personal, I want to write myself. The hitch was the students had different notions of what counted as personal. So was writing a job application letter personal or not? And one group of people said, boy, I'd like to have that done for me. I don't have to do it myself. Other people said a job application is a presentation of me, so that's personal. What everybody agreed was that love letters and poetry, they wanted to write themselves.
Except the funny thing is that ChatGPT does a great job with both of those.
It does.
That's the thing. I'm not talking about like wonderful poetry. it can generate all that stuff very, very quickly and effortlessly because it's good at divergent
generation. Have you seen the new poetry camera? Which I just read about. It's a camera that's rigged up with software that takes a photograph and then writes a poem about the photograph. And there's a little printer in the camera that will print out your poem for you. I mean, the world is changing.
I'm not sure what I think about that. I think this is where there's this edge on talking about the potential of these tools, especially used by artists and musicians and creative writers. But then there is this month. I do think that there's this bigger piece around thinking and who where are your thoughts coming from and how do you identify and attribute where your ideas come from. You know, that's something that is that the sort of, there's sort of a black box to all of these things, and it's sometimes hard to tell where the ideas come from.
But let's see what's been happening in the last, particularly 6 months, in the service of what's called explainable AI. One of the things that Google undertook to do with Bard come Gemini, and forget about the faux pas. One of the things that I undertook to do was to say, here are the sources for what I've written. So the difference between using a chatbot and a search engine is the search engine locates something that is on the web, and a chatbot writes something new for you. Now, with the search engine, you have the sources, but let's be honest with ourselves. Most of the time, most people do not check those sources. So just because you can cite the source that you that you're referencing for a search that you did doesn't mean you have any notion of whether it's true or not. So for Gemini to say, oh, these are the sources that we pulled from the web or from wherever for our generated answer for you, doesn't necessarily tell you whether what has been pulled is true or not. But the goal is to say we can be more accountable. And the argument that many people have given, that I'm sure you know, is, you know, we stand not just on the shoulders of giants, but we've read things ourselves, and they constitute part of what we take to be knowledge. And therefore, how different is that from an AI reading, that's in quotation marks, and drawing upon that information to write something that perhaps is similar in terms of the information that you would write yourself based upon what you had read or looked up in, heaven help us, a real book. So it's not a clear division between who knows where AI got its answers from versus what about where humans get their answers from. The fundamental difference, and there have been some really nice discussions of this, particularly from a woman who's sometimes called the godmother of artificial intelligence, Fei-Fei Li, at Stanford University's Center for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. She said the difference of what AI does is it constructs its answers, its knowledge, its responses differently from the way humans do. But that doesn't mean that the answer that the AI and the humans come up with are going to look all that different. So I think we have to be mindful that there's a difference between how you got your answer and what the answer is.
Yes. And here's where I think I see myself both applauding the attempts at accountability, yes, indeed. But I've also thought about, well, now that this is finally happening with Gemini, mm-hmm. and I can get some version that I can perhaps have students test with it. I think this is a good way for me to use this as a class exercise, mm-hmm. to show. Okay, here are some of the sources that the AI came up with. But what sources would you come up with? Or I might have them write a piece. And this is, and what, where this really matters is when you're talking about personal nonfiction, when you're talking about, mm-hmm. personal essay writing, because it isn't just a matter of information. Indeed. It's not just a matter of this is the source for X. It's oftentimes, how did I develop my sensibility and my particular way of looking at the world? How did I get these ideas? Where did they come from? And I see this, you know, when I talk about first-person journalism, that's a dimension of that kind of writing. And I'm oftentimes pushing students, where did your ideas come from? Not because I want, you know, I do want attribution and sources. But beyond that, I was like, why do you think that? Why? You know, where is that going to take you? I mean, that's what I think the project is. And if you do love writing, personal nonfiction, that's what drives you. I'm going to just read, this is a quick quote from you. It's from a 2023 opinion piece you did that appeared in the Conversation, that, mm-hmm. digital site.
Yes.
And the title, and this was right after, I mean, it was like, well, I don't know, a month and a half after ChatGPT had, you know, publicly been released. So, and the name of that was, what was that article called? How ChatGPT Robbed Students of Motivation to Write and Think for Themselves. And so in it, you touch on various AI tools, in addition to chatbots that existed before this release of ChatGPT, Grammarly, and then what Microsoft Editor had earlier iterations. And then there's autocomplete that we're all familiar with, you know, at this point. And you call those domesticated technologies, which kind of we now take for granted, right? But here's what you say. These tools inject themselves into our writing endeavors without being invited, incessantly asking us to follow their suggestions. And I would say in that article and in your book, you report that a number of writers and students feel their own voice is stripped out by tools like this, as if the piece is not by them anymore. So this is kind of a variation on some of what I've already asked, but what qualities are missing when an AI intervenes in this way?
Well, the first quality that's missing is time, by which I mean, if you're going to figure out what word you wanted to use in that text message, you may have to actually pause when you start with a couple of letters and then say, no, that's not actually what I wanted to say. And the question is, to what extent are we willing to take even a couple seconds more to draw the word for ourselves? So I'll give an example where I'm guilty. I'm writing, you know, a paragraph. Let's say it's for an article or an opinion piece or whatever it is. And I realize I have repeated the word challenge. And I was writing something today and I realized I had used the word challenge twice. So I needed a different word. In the olden days, I would either pull out a thesaurus or have to think for myself. But by the time I went to my shelf and got the book, maybe I had already thought of, well, what would be another word? These days, I'm guilty. I know what to click on. I know how to look up synonyms. And the listing is often not very useful, although occasionally it's useful. But what it stops me from having to do is work myself, to use my brain. And one of the challenges that I think is happening is instead of, as even what I call, and others do as well, everyday writers, just writing an email to someone. You know, if you're doing Gmail and you've got, the Gmail tools on that will finish your sentences, or these days, Microsoft Outlook does the same thing for me. It's all there. Is that the way that I would have said it if I had taken the few seconds to figure out what I wanted to say? Often no, but boy, it's so much faster to just hit tab and five words come out and I don't have to work on it. So my concern is that these tools are being increasingly pushed out at us. When I wrote the book, when I wrote the first drafts, Microsoft Editor didn't do that to me. Now it does. And will that just become the new norm, the same as spell check, which started as a tool where if you were given an alternative spelling to what you had proposed and you had to say yay or nay? These days, it just corrects your spell check just corrects your spelling
it
for
does.
You. I asked some of my students, do you use spell check? And some of them said no. And I didn't realize you could turn spell check off. I didn't know that. Okay. My European students knew it in the surveys that I did. The American students didn't seem to be aware of it.
Researching and writing this book changed your own views on writing and authorship?
Probably the biggest impact on my own writing is becoming aware of the real difference between process and product. Process being how did you get there? And did you end up where you thought you were going to end up? And what does the finished product look like? So to some extent, let me give an analogy, if I might. Think about somebody going into surgery where there is a very skilled surgeon doing a complex operation. And you pay that surgeon a whole lot of money, he or she, because of his or her real skills. And then, and actually I experienced this, my husband had surgery recently, the surgeon came out and told me how it went. But the process wasn't finished because the other people in the operating room had to do the sewing and the cleaning up and whatever. Okay, so the sewing and the cleaning up is the multiple drafts after you finally have figured out, if you can follow my analogy, the surgery is done and it was a complex process. Yeah. And now let's say it was a process and you weren't sure exactly what to do when you were going to do this, but then you ended up doing that. And then when that's finished, then there are multiple rounds of editing. So what I tell people, and it's true, I have 7 drafts of this book. And each draft represents several times I went through things. And the last 2 drafts, I would say, which had multiple subdrafts within them, were the polishing, were the sewing up and the cleaning up. And that's a different process from the thinking things through. But every once in a while, you say, when you thought you were just doing cleanup, you know what? This argument doesn't hold. And actually what happened with me on this book, and I write a little bit about it, but there's more to the story. I had turned in the final draft of the book to Stanford University Press the first week of November 2022. Oh, what happened on November 30th, 2022? All hell broke loose. That's what happened. So I had polished everything. The language was done. I knew I was finished. And suddenly, there had to be some major changes made, right?
Well, November 30th, 2022 was when ChatGPT was publicly released.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for articulating that. Yeah. So sometimes you think you're done, but you're not. So to answer your question of what has changed in me, it's an understanding that the difference between getting all the pieces where they need to go and then polishing are not necessarily 2 distinct stages, because you may realize things about your own argument. Things may happen in the world and you have to make a large number of changes, but you have to make them fast because the press wants to get the book out, right? So I have been thinking a lot about process versus product. One of the things that particularly moved me, and this happened really within weeks of the time that ChatGPT was released at the end of November 2022, was there's a teachers union in Norway of teachers of Norwegian language and literature. So teachers union just means organization. And they came out with a set of concerns that were radically different from the concerns that Americans were starting to voice about ChatGPT. Their concern was not, were students going to cheat? Which for the, you know, at least the first half of 2023 was the biggest university concern, and that hasn't gone away. Their concern was, if students don't do their own writing and grappling with the process of figuring out what they want to say and how they want to say it, what will happen to democracy? And they were very clear. Now, they wrote this in Norwegian, and I cannot tell a lie. I used Microsoft Translate.
I used AI to translate.
And then I consulted with a Norwegian colleague of mine to make sure I was getting this right. But their concern, I think, was the right concern. It was, what becomes of us as a society when we can't work out for ourselves what's in our heads and what we put into our heads and the sense we make of it.
That's beautifully put. I mean, those concerns, of course, reflect some of my concerns. And again, it's about all of these things that have to do with how do we take in information? How do we interpret it? How do we think about it? Now, many people, you quote a number of writers and others in your book that say this, and I've certainly read this all over the place, that more and more what we're going to be doing when we're talking about writing, especially if we're talking about nonfiction, not necessarily mm-hmm. creative writing, but nonfiction, right. is we're going to be acting as editors or the creative directors. Well, what do you think of that?
Director is a very polite term, and the people who will have jobs as directors is very small, but most people will be doing mop-up operations. In the book, I talk about the experience of people who are professional translators and what has happened to them as translation has gotten better and better. And as the kinds of places they used to get jobs for doing full translations are now hiring them to be, the technical term is post-editors. Mm-hmm. And some of the people whose work I have great respect for and who did surveys, and I've quoted some of the people who were surveyed, it's very clear that for the overwhelming majority of people who are professional translators, this is an affront to their skills. This is relegating them to the lowest level of janitorial work. And I have great respect for janitors because they keep our lives going. But there are many other things that many janitors are able to do, but if they are only able to spend their time mopping the floor and emptying trash cans, they can't show their abilities. So my huge concern now is that the way that corporations that are paying the big bucks to Microsoft for using what Microsoft is calling Copilot, and let's just say I have a relative, to remain nameless, who is working for a very large corporation, a multinational corporation, to remain nameless, that is paying the big bucks to Microsoft for Copilot. Their goal is to check up and to clean up as opposed to write themselves. And mm-hmm. this is going to become the problem writ large for so many of us. And that will go for technical writing. It's going to go for academic writing, not just students, but faculty. Interestingly, publishers such as Elsevier, which I do a lot of reviewing for their journals, they came out with a statement that I guess they sent to everybody who reviews, who said, please be aware, our policy says that you may use an AI to correct your grammar, but you may not use an AI to write your article, or, oh, reviewers, you may not use it to write the review. And I just cited in a talk I gave a week or so ago a really interesting paper by AI researchers on the reviews that were written of proposals sent to one of the premier AI conferences over the last 3 or 4 years. And there were these charts in the paper of how often particular adjectives were used. And for 2024 articles that were sent for review, there were half a dozen or so adjectives that suddenly were used in profusion, that before they were used only a little bit, you know, interesting and innovative mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. And it's clear that AI wrote the reviews, and that the professional people in AI who were asked to give their professional opinions of papers were not writing the reviews. This is where the world is going to go. Did they gussy things up a little bit? Did they clean up around the edges? Did they do the sewing and the mop-up operations in surgery? I don't know. but I know that the words that were being used, I mean, they were just, it's blatant. It's, you know, chug, 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 and then suddenly the line goes up on the graph. This is what the world is going to increasingly look like because it's really efficient.
Yes.
And our lives have to be about more than efficiency. One of the things that I enjoy about reviewing manuscripts is being able to call on things that I've learned from what I've written, from experiences I've had, from knowing about work that other people are doing. Some of it may be unpublished at this point. And I can bring that to the table. And that is personal. Is it a point of view? No, it's the knowledge and experience that I happen to have that other people don't have. So let me now segue back to my book, if I might. An argument that I made when I was pitching my book proposal was, this is a book that I don't think anybody else could write. How many people are there out there who know enough about artificial intelligence, either knew a lot to begin with, because I've written on AI and computer languages and that kind of thing in the past, and then I learned a whole lot, but also know a lot about writing, about teaching writing, not in the way that you do, but the way that I, as a, of course, regular faculty member, have done. I know a lot about the history of writing. I know a whole lot about reading. I know about editing. I know about translation. And how many people could put that mix, and I know how to do primary research, and so there's primary research in the book. How many people could put those pieces together? I think it's an N of one. Okay. So in that sense, there are things that we as post-editors, as it were, could do more effectively if we were the original writers, because we would be free to, I'd like to hope, even motivated to ask, what is inside me, inside my head, inside my world of experiences, that makes what I could contribute to something that I write myself, or that some, or evaluating someone else's work? What voice could I bring, not in the sense of this is my particular take on such and such a controversial issue, but what do I bring as a human being? One of the things in my writing, and these are now technical articles sometimes, one of the things that I'm able to do is bring in examples of things that I've experienced in my life. And sometimes I camouflage things a little bit so that it's not just, oh, what is Naomi Barron? And, you know, what did she do at this stage of her life that she has this example? But it's a way of illustrating things. It's a way of talking about things that I've heard people say. You know, I'm a linguist, so I teach courses on linguistics, and I need to give examples of language use. And just observing what people say or don't say, and being in situation, or what they write, and being in situations lets me bring those lived experiences to the argument that I'm trying to make. So if you'll bear with me for a second, I'd like to just reference what in some ways was a really moving experience for me as an undergraduate. And it's the way that I end the book. And it had to do with a paper that I wrote as a sophomore in a literature course. That was, of course, much more difficult than I was ready for, because it was mostly graduate students. It was on literary criticism from Plato to Dryden. It was taught by a poet. And I tried very hard to write a paper And I don't remember the exact topic, but I knew I had no idea what I was talking about. I mean, I really was the wise fool sophomore. And the paper came back with one comment on it from the professor, who, as I say, was a poet, and he didn't suffer fools. What he wrote across the front was, "This is a kindergartner's mishmash of a history of ideas. F, as in fail." Okay. That comment, once I licked my wounds, I recovered from, and I said to myself, eventually, because it took a while to recover, I was going to learn how to write. I didn't know what writing really was about. I mean, I had done some pretty pedantic stuff. I had had my freshman comp course. I could do the grammar and style, but and argumentation, but I didn't know how to really build something that was worth arguing in a context of literary criticism. And what's clear to me is these moments in one's life can shape how one thinks about one's writing. And that one, for sure, shaped the way that I think about AI as a writing tool. So what I wrote was that I was immeasurably grateful that a skilled human didn't miss words with this neophyte. No AI grammar or style tutor could have been as blunt and as effective. Now, I know that students today would probably simply bring a case against the faculty member for having said such really nasty things. So this was back in the day when faculty members could say this, and you just said, okay, I guess I deserve the F, right? You didn't contest it. But I think this notion of taking experiences in one's life, either for shaping how one becomes a writer, and one hopes at least a reasonably good one, or at least passable, or how one thinks about integrating something into a book. And there was a reason I really wanted to end the book with a perspective that says, you know, unless you specifically train an AI to be blunt, and these days things like Claude will not be blunt because it's engineered not to be blunt.
No, that's very nice.
You're never going to have somebody standing up, or something, standing up to you to say, you know what? This doesn't cut it. You need to hear this in a loud voice. This doesn't cut it. And all the politeness that we have raised the current generation, and we've raised the millennials on it, and Gen X and Gen Z on it. If you don't have something nice to say, don't say it. Say it gently. It doesn't have a whole lot of effect in most cases. Sometimes being direct can make a difference. So I wanted to end the book with that message to say, think about what you want. You know, what if the dream came true and you only got nice comments on your writing? Is that what you really want?
Right. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then you had a brief quote that you were going to read.
Okay.
What are your top three suggestions for writers in an AI world? Should we be afraid? Should we embrace technology? What are your top three?
The first is understand as much as you can of what the technology does and does not do. Understand its powers, understand its perils. Know that some of those will change over time, but be as knowledgeable as you can be. And that goes for writers, and it also goes for faculty, because they are passing judgment on students. Should you use the technology? Should you not use the technology? But if you don't know what the technology is, it's hard to formulate any kind of reasonable judgment. So that would be step one. Know what's going on with the technology. The second step is I'll take something from the nuclear arms treaties that the United States used to have with Russia. Trust but verify.
That's my motto these days.
and this goes not just for AI, but for anything on the web or for other sources for that matter.
Yeah.
It's become really too easy for us to say, you know, we used to say, don't trust everything in print. Now we'll say, don't trust everything online. And online can mean that is digital. So that could mean on the internet, or it could mean coming from an AI. And the third is respect yourself. Respect what you're capable of thinking. Respect yourself to be able to get up if you fall down in your writing. If someone says, this makes no sense, GPT would have done a better job, why didn't you just use it and don't bug me with this? Respect that you have ideas in your head, that you have words in your head. You don't always have to accept what predictive texting, either in an actual text or in an email, tells you is a simple way to finish something. Be a person and decide for yourself what words you want under your byline.
I love that. And before I have you read this last quote, did you guess which of those questions came from ChatGPT that I asked?
No, because I was just too busy engaging with the questions and thinking about how I could maybe have something of use to say. So you tell me, please.
The one that came from ChatGPT was, how has researching and writing this book changed your own views on writing and authorship? And I actually thought that was a good question. And I'll send you the 10 that it came up with. I asked to come up with 10.
Okay.
And it came up with a number that would have been things that I might have asked about. Some of them had to do more with your personal story. And I had some of those in my interview notes. But I figured, well, if we have a good conversation, I'm not going to sort of lean on that. That's kind of like generic interview stuff, you know. I think, you know, when we're thinking about all of this, you know, and all the tests I've done with it, it's, I kind of feel like if I'm in control, if I can make choices,
right,
if I've already written my own first draft or made my own notes, it could be very helpful. It could, you know, bring up something, but yeah, that's all about staying, I think for me, staying in control as a writer.
I agree. And as for did ChatGPT write the question, it did sound, as you presented it, a little more formal than the other questions. But if you asked me, could I, you know, blind test, tell which the question was, it would have been a guess.
Right.
It would have been a guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that I, you know, want to be pushing people to do is to be testing these technologies and to think about how they work, because, you know, you have to know the devil at the very least. And maybe the devil's not just always a devil either. That's the other issue. Anyway, why don't you read this closing quote, and then we'll wrap up our discussion here.
So I assume we're talking about a quotation from a woman named Jennifer Lepp.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lepp is an author who distributes, she's an indie author. She distributes her book on Amazon Kindle Direct Publishing. She's a specialist in paranormal cozy mystery, which actually is a genre. I looked it up. And she writes a new book really every few weeks on how the heck does she make that happen. She works really hard. But then she realized that there is this tool called PseudoWrite, which uses GPT-3, OpenAI licensed GPT-3, the predecessor of 3.5, which is ChatGPT, predecessor of GPT-4. They've licensed GPT-3 to many, many, many people and organizations, one of which is a company called PseudoWrite that would write things for you. So she started using it for short descriptions. And that saved her a lot of time, and that was nice. But then after a while, what she found is that she was using it more and more often for longer and longer passages. And at one point, she realized that something was happening. And what was happening is she no longer felt that she was immersed in her characters and in her plots. And as she put it, she no longer dreamt about them, which she used to when she did all the writing. What she said in an interview was, at this point, it didn't feel like mine anymore. It was very uncomfortable to look back over what I wrote and not really feel connected to the words and ideas. And that's because she didn't write them.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.